Good morning and welcome to Beyond Ferguson, White Fear, Black Anger, American Rage on WILL AM 580. I'm Janice Marie Collins, host of Theoretical Tea and Company. Thank you for tuning in. The title of the show today, such an intense title. Why? Because the subject and their acts are just that, intense. These are the common themes echoed in the media and communities across the country, with all of the senseless killings that we have observed. The purpose of this show, however, is to continue the conversations and initiate conversations that are necessary in our search for truth, understanding, and most importantly, healing. Healing for everyone, every race, every American. It's not a matter of agreement nor solid and tested solutions. It is simply a matter of learning to live together in peace. And living in peace means living in truth, even if it hurts just a little. From the pages of newspapers, sounds and visuals from online television and radio news reports, there appears to be a growing and disturbing trend emerging. I say appears because, as we'll discuss a little later, this is not the beginning of such trends, as we would call it. So the question is it really a trend, or is it something that we just have to acknowledge and address because of social media? We're seeing a lot more of it. We're talking about the killing of unarmed young Black males at the hands of police officers or just regular citizens who may have taken matters into their own hands. One of the latest cases involves 18-year-old Micah Brown, who was shot 6 times by a police officer, according to the autopsy report. And while there may be debates as to whether or not he was charging the officer or simply standing with his hands up, like in so many other cases, what we do know at the very least is that there appears to be what some would call overkill. But I would propose, by focusing on simply the acts, especially when it hasn't been tried in a court of law, I think we're missing an opportunity to examine the bigger and deeper questions. We must move beyond Ferguson. So the question becomes, one of the main questions, why does it appear that the killing of this kind continues? Why are unarmed Black males being killed? Give us a call, 800-222-9455, with your response, question, and comment. I really want you to get involved in this conversation so that we can all learn from each other. You may have to hold for a moment or two, but we'll get to your call as soon as we can. You can also join the conversation on Twitter, hashtag WILL Beyond Ferguson. I'd like to introduce you to my first guest to help begin and initiate this conversation. I am pleased to be joined by Sudiata Chajua, a professor in African American Studies at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Thank you for joining me this morning.
Glad to be here, Janice.
Okay. So let me first begin by asking you, your opinion, why does it appear that Black males are continuously being killed in this manner?
Well, I mean, I think it goes back to the nature of policing of the African-American community in that particular relationship. So that on the one hand, if we think about it in more broad general terms, we would have to think about African-Americans as a kind of internal colony. And that the force that occupies and polices, and I'm using policing not in its positive sense here, are police officers. So what you have is a situation where their role is to contain and control and often to repress. That's the structural role. Given that role, then you find that when there's an encounter, It often takes the form of excessive force. There's also the question of the way in which black males in particular, but black people in general, are represented in the media. The image that white Americans and others grow up with about black men as always threatening, lazy, prone toward theft. And those images have circulated, in media going back into the 1830s with the beginning of minstrelry. And those things tend to, you know, form a deep seed bed in white consciousness. Mm-hmm. And so given the structural role and then given the image and ideology that whites have of African-Americans, and again, particularly young black males, mm-hmm. These leads to situations where they don't value the life. So in a confrontation, it's very easy mm-hmm. to take the life of a young black male.
So let me ask you this then. When you talk about the image portrayals that are constructed and have been constructed for decades,
for centuries, as far as
black males, mm-hmm. if the constructed image that fits violence, criminality, or criminal acts, if you will, have been constructed in the uniform of not only a black male, let's just say, because if you see a police officer, that uniform represents something, and you should know how to interact, behave, respond based upon that uniform. Okay, there's one aspect of it. So let's look at black males in the uniform of black masculinity, uniform of black males. Okay. Because black males have been constructed within an image that relates to violence, not being trustworthy, villains for a long period of time, is it really the fault of the individual? Because if this is part of the culture, then what would you say to the fact that they may have been conditioned subconsciously, incognizant way of responding to that black male, which then would mean we need to just educate more people and have different images, perhaps. Would some of that hold the blame?
Obviously, when I say it's a structural problem, I mean that it's a societal problem that's built into its basic institutions and the relationships that flow from that. But just because one has been miseducated to mm-hmm. hold certain racist views mm-hmm. doesn't excuse racist behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, you still don't get to shoot someone mm-hmm. Repeatedly
right.
just because of who they are, right? Mm-hmm. So,
it doesn't excuse it. Right.
But what it does is it forces us not to focus so much on the individual. Of course, in a case like this, the Michael Brown situation, the Eric Garner situation, mm-hmm. those particular police officers must be punished for the actions that they took. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't resolve the problem. The problem
exactly.
is broader, it's structural. Mm-hmm. I'm part of a team. My wife Helen Neville and I, Michael Slosher, who mm-hmm. runs the Police Training Institute, we're doing diversity training with police officers, mm-hmm. and we're trying to cut into the problem at that level. And what I can say in terms of the data that we've gathered so far, and we've done about 6 months of training with two or three different classes mm-hmm. at the Police Training Institute, is that police officers, like the general white citizenry, mm-hmm. and hold deep-seated anti-black views.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Very deep-seated anti-black views. And these things are reinforced through how they interpret the nature of their job,
do. Let's move away. I want to do this. Let's move away, though, from the aspect of just police officers, because that's not the issue as far as we can say that about a lot of different aspects. And I'll give you a prime example. If I'm an African-American and I may have been cultured in a particular area, I come from the military, I have a military background. So I had a lot of diversity for most of my life, mostly white Americans or international soldiers. We had to host, my father was a retired colonel from the Army, so we had to host a lot of families from different countries. And so we had this commonality of just protecting America. We were soldiers even as children. Okay, so we had this patriotic type of idea, and everyone looked alike. So all of my African Americans, all of my white, all of my Asian, we all dressed the same. We all had the same. Okay. So if I go into a certain area and I have been conditioned to think and believe a certain image, I may not be afraid of that individual because perhaps as an African American, I may have more opportunities to discuss and interact with individuals that may have the hoodie, that may wear their pants down, and I know them as great people. But if I'm an individual, even black, if I don't have that experience, then there may be a possibility that I am going to fear them in some way because I have no other experience other than what I see portrayed in the media or in journalism or in our lives, in our families. For instance, families, if they don't have diversity, schools, if they don't have diversity, then we're more apt to, possibly, because there's some individuals that grow up without being around any black people and they have no racism. So I'm saying it in a way it's a black and white issue, but in a way it isn't, because of the fact of how individuals, especially in America, have been conditioned.
I mean, look, we live in a racist society. So once we put that on the table, that's clear. But the question is, just because a person has been miseducated, do we then excuse their actions?
I want to make that clear, though. We're not excusing the actions. We're not excusing the actions because that's obvious. But what I want us to actually talk about is not the excuse, but more of the explanations. So leading to solutions, leading to an understanding of sorts.
So the first thing I would say is this, that it's not simply a matter of fear. And it may be less a matter of fear than a question of devaluing.
Okay.
Dehumanization. Not seeing African Americans as part of the country, not seeing them as part of your group, that's at the core. And that it's that dehumanization that probably produces elements of fear.
Okay.
Now, the question is, how do we solve that? And I think we have to talk very clearly that in order to change these images, you're going to have to do a lot of things in terms of rewriting the history that people are introduced to. You're going to have to change media presentations, all of that. You're going to have to have a kind of training, a retraining in this society. But the depth of that, right, the depth of that would be so total in terms of what happens in U.S. society and culture, how you'd have to rework that, that's only going to occur if there is some fundamental transformation in power in the society, because that's what it ultimately comes back to.
But power also in power in defining oneself, power in, for instance, black males, because black males, I hold black males responsible for defining themselves as well. So, for instance, if a black male commits crime after crime after crime after crime, he's defining himself and he's going to allow individuals to judge him by his acts. Same thing if a white person does the same thing. They're going to define themselves. I think the difference is that there's a hasty generalization, if you will, on a negative level, that if a black person commits a crime, a black male commits a crime, it seems to be judged as more heinous, perhaps, in certain respects, but not by all. And I want to get back to some of these crimes.
Like, for example, look, you're using crime in a very static way as if it represents some kind of a universal value.
Sure.
Selling loose cigarettes. I don't know that should be a crime. Right. A large number of these young men that we're talking about who have been shot and killed, if we go from Abner Diallo on down, they weren't even suspected of a crime.
Sure. And so then we get back to the other piece is this.
The other piece is this. Look. If we're going to deal with what we know as scholars, we know that there's a direct relationship between unemployment and crime, right? With each rise in unemployment, there's a corresponding rise in what we call crime. So we have to understand that as a function of the society and not a question of an individual's character.
It's
tied to the nature of the society. It depends on the crime.
Right.
Okay.
It depends on the
so
crime.
If you want to end crime, you would probably go much further and be more successful if you lower unemployment, if there's decent housing, if there's real educational opportunity. And so, you know, I'm always leery of narratives that want to focus things down to individual behavior.
Exactly.
Because if it's a question of individual behavior and we're talking crime, then we're talking millions of people, right, across centuries who have engaged in this. Thus, we have to think of it as a structural problem and not a moral deficiency.
Of course, it's a structural problem. I think that we've made that clear. when we talk about the systemic racism of the infrastructure. I think mm-hmm. we make that clear. When we talk about the uniform of a black male, there's also the uniform of certain acts that are not socially accepted among individuals who wear suits. But that is not what is portrayed prevalently in this society. So I want to bring in Aaron Ammons to, as we're talking about, because I still want to look at this aspect of fear. It is real. The fear is real. And it is not that it's malicious. It's not that it is actually individuals saying honestly, because of my upbringing, because, and I'm not excusing, but I'm saying that we also have to allow others to say, you know what, I do have this fear. We have to allow them to say that so that we can say, tell me where this fear is, so that we can redirect it, revise it, educate, understand. So is the fear real? So I want to bring in Aaron Ammons, who is a social justice advocate. And I want to bring Aaron in now because, as Sundiata Chajua talked about, there's a socialization aspect here, right? And then you have the infrastructure, which is policy and things along those lines. Aaron is also the co-founder of CU Citizens for Peace and Justice. Is there any validity, realness to this fear, and should it be addressed?
Okay. First of all, I want to thank you for having me on the show. Mm-hmm. And I really mm-hmm. appreciate these spaces so we can have these type of conversations. And I want to preface my statements by saying I don't have an answer completely formulated. So I hope the listeners will give me a little bit of space. Is the fear real? And we're talking about what you described in your title as white fear. Mm-hmm. And is it real? The only thing that stands out to me, the one thing that stands out to me mm-hmm. that allows me to sort of come to that conclusion that there is a fear mm-hmm. is that I have been also conditioned by the imagery that I see in the society, period, but definitely television and things like that.
The image of the black male and, yes. and his masculinity.
Yes, yes,
okay.
Yes.
How has that influenced you?
Well, I think that it's pretty clear that the message, the dominant narrative, is that this is someone who will do harm to you mm-hmm. or who has the potential to do harm to you, has no real moral character, and is to be, you should be leery of this person, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And when you run across someone, an African-American male who's not, that's an anomaly, so to speak. That's sort of the feeling that I get. And I think that it is also clearer to me, or it makes me think about this when I hear what you said, unarmed young black male killed. Unarmed. So repeatedly what we hear in the news and what we see on television or we see in social media is that I would say the vast majority of the young black males who we see killed at the hands of a police officer somewhere in the country, they were unarmed. Mm-hmm. They were wallet. It was a, you know, it was some situation.
But again, I don't want us to necessarily focus on, and that's a great point, but I don't want us to just focus on that, because there have been individuals who have been killed who aren't unarmed because their music was too loud. There have been individuals who have been killed because there was a knock on the door in the middle of the night. There have been individuals killed because they were making sure the neighborhood was safe mm-hmm. in the middle of a rainy night. So that's why I said I want us to move past this Ferguson and the idea that it's police against them. It's not just authorities, if you will, of official. It's not. That's why I said there has to be. There has to be a reason. And the moment that we continue, you know, from my perspective, the moment we continue and say, your fear has no place, your fear has no validity, is the moment that sometimes we're missing opportunities to say, you know, yes, if you were profiled, for instance, and your behavior was this or that, that either perpetuated that stereotype or disconnected from that stereotype. There is something that changed in you, not just in your choices in life, but there's something that changed maybe even in your appearance. So before I get your answer, and I'm going to bring in a retired sergeant, a police officer who can also add a lot to this conversation. I want to remind everyone, we'd love to hear your opinion and your questions and comments. Give us a call on 800-222-9455 or on Twitter, hashtag WILL Beyond Ferguson. So, Aaron, real quickly, you know, did it change you when you said, okay, I was being profiled? What did you do to change? What, or did someone else change? Did the system change?
Well, first, I'd like to go back just briefly to, I definitely understand that this isn't just about the police. If we're going to talk about categorizing a African-American people as having black fear, or white Americans having black rage and white fear, then, you know, you're lumping everybody into this group and saying that they all have the same thing. So I'm not just speaking to the police. I do think that it's pretty clear that we're all conditioned by the things that we see and we experience within the society.
Sure.
For me personally, I realized that if I was, I could not do some of the things that I was doing and escape the stigma that came with that, or the label that came with that behavior. I had to own up to that. So I'm
and you're referring to as a young man.
As a young man.
You participated in particular acts. Mm-hmm. And then you grew out of that, but you also accept the responsibility that of that stigma that went with that.
Right.
Is that
Absolutely.
What you're saying?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I think that we have to, in order for me to be able to see a problem, to see it clearly, I have to remove my contributions to that problem, right? Then I can see clearly what it for what it is.
Okay.
So I don't want to be blinded by my defensiveness or me projecting upon somebody else something just to get the heat off of me, right?
Yeah.
You know
yeah.
what I mean? So I don't
yeah.
want to do that. I don't think that's productive for us at all.
Right.
So for me, as I looked back through and the changes that I made, I realized that they were actually individual decisions that I had to make, because no one else was going to make that decision for me to change and go into a different course of life.
But you made that
so
decision.
I made that decision, but it was connected to reading, researching history, and my own experience and the education that I was getting outside of a formal system. It was me going to the library, getting historical books, and understanding the nature and the environment, the culture in which I lived in.
Okay.
And so once I became fed up with that, then I chose to go in a different route and to walk a different path. So there is personal responsibility inherent in whatever that you're doing, regardless of the circumstance that you're in.
But it's also the system. And so what we're finding is that you can't disconnect.
Something.
You can't just disconnect one element and not the other.
Right.
Before we go to break, and we also have a caller on the line, on line one, before we go to break, I want to bring in retired Sergeant Donald Shelton. I'm so happy that he could, he has been to join us today. I'm happy that he could join us today. He was a former Champaign police officer for 23 years and is also the member of the Illinois Prisoner Review Board. And so I ask you, thank you for joining me, first of all. Thank you for joining us here, Donald. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So before we go to break, and I'd like to take the call on line one, and I'm going to, after break, I'm going to let you start off the conversation. Do you have any response at this time of what we've been talking about as far as fear, culpability, responsibility, the whole aspect of individual black males being killed that are unarmed?
Well, I will have a response for that. Are you waiting for me to respond more specifically after the break, or do you want me to address it now?
Okay. If you can briefly address it now, you can, or we can come back right after the break.
Well, I would say for the moment that the thing that concerns me the most with regard to this topic is the tendency to speak very generally and not speak specifically, because I think when we talk generally about these sorts of events without knowing the specifics of any of these events, it's, you know, we're just as likely to be wrong about any conclusions we reach as we are to be right. So I'm really uncomfortable speaking generally about events that I can't talk to more specifically about. I know the facts of a lot of things that have occurred in Champaign. I know nothing about what's going on in Missouri.
Sure.
And I think a lot of people are prone to speak inappropriately simply because they don't know the fact. Do any of us really know what the heck's going on in Missouri? I sure don't.
Yes. I'm glad you brought that up, and that's the point of this conversation, is that we're moving beyond Ferguson. And in moving beyond Ferguson, we're going to take a quick break at this moment, a really quick break, and then we're going to come back on the lines with Shirley. Shirley, we'll be right back with you in just a few moments. Welcome back. Welcome back. You're listening to WILL Beyond Ferguson, AM 580. I'm your host, Janice Marie Collins. We have some special guests in the studio. We also have an opportunity for you to call in on the lines, 800-222-9455, and on Twitter, hashtag WILL Beyond Ferguson. Going to line number one, we have Shirley on line number one. Yes, Shirley, thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for the program.
You're so welcome.
Comments concern, I'm not denying that there is fear, white fear of African Americans, but I think when we get focused on just fear, we forget white entitlement and white privilege. And when we're talking about police in particular, their notions of entitlement are certainly somewhat justified. They have authority. Your everyday European American, that stands for white, for those of you who don't know, also, there's a sense of entitlement, and because I can, and everybody, Florida drives me crazy anymore. The Zimmerman case drove me absolutely nuts, because it's like as soon as I say, well, you scared me, I feel threatened, then therefore I get to kill you, and I think forgetting or not acknowledging that sense of entitlement, I belong here and you don't belong here, which may, again, be at a very low level of awareness for lots of folks, but it certainly does play an important role.
Absolutely. Thank you, Shirley. Thank you for that great comment. And you're right, white entitlement. And that's what we're talking about as well, and we're going to get to that with when Sudiata Chachua, and where I'm moving to, is the issue of power, with that white entitlement where that says, it doesn't really matter if I'm a police officer or not. If I have white entitlement and I fear you, I'm going to respond in a particular way that makes sure I'm protected. And I think that's what we have to look at and we have to examine. I also want to go to line two as well, and then we're going to come back to Donald Shelton, retired police officer. We have Imani on line two. Thank you for joining us, Imani.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
And I appreciate you doing the show.
My pleasure.
I promise I tried to sit on my hands and not call, but I couldn't
That's okay.
help myself.
That's all right. That's all right. Yeah, can you keep it less than 5 minutes, though, Imani?
Of course. Yes.
Okay, here we go.
No, I'm calling out of distress.
Okay.
Because it seems as though the conversation continues to be steered toward African Americans in general and African American men in particular having to justify who they are, mm-hmm. and having to answer for other people's fear of them. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just concerned we're going to go through the whole show and have found ourselves going further and further along that trajectory.
Yes.
Instead of getting off of that mark, because mm-hmm. I know you said you're going to talk mm-hmm. about power, so I just heard you say that.
Yes, yes.
But I think that's the real issue. And then quickly, the second thing is just I kept hearing Dr. Chajua mm-hmm. Trying to talk about structural racism or institutional oppression, but he kept being pulled back into a conversation about the personal instead of the structural. And so I'm just saying, when we're looking to analyze and understand things and when we're looking for answers, I think it's going to be important to distinguish. Are we talking about solutions for people's personal racism mm-hmm. or personal bias or distrust, or are we talking about solutions and analysis solutions to the problem of structural oppression. Okay. I think those are two different conversations.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Imani. Thank you so much for taking having the courage to call in. And thank you, Shirley, for calling in. Don't forget, you can call in at 800-222-9455. On Twitter, hashtag WILL Beyond Ferguson. You're listening to Beyond Ferguson on AM 580. I want to give Donald, a retired police officer, an opportunity to join in the conversation a little bit more. Donald, your response, great responses here, great call-ins about responsibility, about white entitlement, about issues of power. What resonates most with you, and what position do you think is important for us to actually address?
Well, you know, I'm not sure what the value of my contribution here will be because my experience, this really doesn't resonate with my experience. I mean, as a police officer and even as a supervisor, you know, I come to work. I have a pretty good idea what I'm expected to do during the course of my work. I go out on the street. If I make traffic stops or I respond to calls, I simply do what I think is the appropriate thing to do. Now, one of our former police chiefs used to say something that I have lived with ever since the first time I heard him say it, and that is doing the right thing at the right time, the right way, for the right reasons. And as long as you feel like you're checking off those boxes when you're addressing people, I have nothing else to talk about.
Okay.
I didn't go out on the street and feel like I had a response for blacks and a response for whites. But obviously, I was unique as a Champaign officer insofar as, you know, I'm African American, and there weren't that many African American police officers.
I think there are seven.
So my experience undoubtedly is going to have been much different than the majority of police officers in Champaign, just mm-hmm. because my position.
Right.
You know, I come to the position from a different place.
Okay. Well, let me ask you about your position then when we're talking about this. Let me ask you, how does the question of power then play out as a police officer? And does it change depending on the person's race?
Well, it changes, I think, depending on the person's demeanor and my perception of it. And I think I can see how that would be a subject of discussion for officers who address people on the street. I mean, obviously, if, you know, we had a course, a man came in, I believe he was from, I want to think he was from the Michigan State Police, who came in and did some coursework for the area police officers, area agencies. And he talked about the issue of, you know, what face do you put on crime? Mm-hmm. And he talked about, you know, officers who, for whatever reason, come to see a black face, mm-hmm. that crime has a black face. Obviously, that affects their perception mm-hmm. When they're dealing with someone who's black. Mm-hmm. But as I think back to my experiences working with the officers that I work with, as I think back to all the videos that I reviewed, all the recordings that I reviewed, I just didn't see it.
Okay.
I wasn't, and truthfully, if there were people on the department who had a racial bent of one sort of another or another, are they going to demonstrate that in front of me?
Mm-hmm.
Of course not.
Right.
So it's.
So you would say then that we perhaps in certain areas where there is a number or percentage of African Americans, for instance, that perhaps the demographics of the police force may have to be one that's a little bit more balanced. So that, well, because there's only one you, perhaps, and there's only seven in Champaign, perhaps. And I'm not saying that white police officers would come about it in a racist way. But again, I look at the training. I look at whether or not there used to be police officers that would work in a certain neighborhood where they were from. They knew the neighbors by name. They knew when their daughters graduated, when they had children. And these cases that I've been researching, these are officers who've had issues in his history of incidences prior to this. They don't live in these neighborhoods. They police these neighborhoods, but they may not feel comfortable. So then there's the issue of power again.
Well, you know, it sounds like you're making the presumption that if the officer is not from that neighborhood, mm-hmm. he's more likely to have a problem in that neighborhood.
No, I said that they don't. I said, I'm not saying that all officers, I'm saying there is a possibility, however, that they may not feel comfortable in particular areas. I'm not talking about mm-hmm. Champaign. I'm talking about
okay,
in certain areas. They just may feel a little uncomfortable. That's possible.
Well, right? Certainly, it's possible. Sure.
Yeah.
I don't know how you want me to respond to
well,
that.
Well, I was just saying that with the demographics and the makeup of the police force, a lot of what's come out in the stories is that they have they deal with African American problems in African American neighborhoods, but the majority of 96% of the police force.
Well, I will say this. I believe that there have been a number of situations that I've responded to as a police officer, where there were officers on the scene before I got there. Mm-hmm. And the officers were white, and they were having a great deal of difficulty coming to any resolution. They're having difficulty even getting to the point of actually having a conversation with people on the scene. And when I got there, I found that some of those persons were more willing to speak to me. And I think the reason has been, at least on some occasions, the fact that I was black. I think that and it may very well also have been because when I showed up, it was obvious that I was a supervisor. So, I mean, you know, if you're having an issue with police officers and a supervisor shows up, black or white, the supervisor is the one to address the issue with, because perhaps he can change the behavior that they perceive as not being appropriate from the officers.
Okay.
But I do think there have been a number of situations where when I showed up because I was black, people were willing to talk with me about issues that weren't being resolved prior to my arrival. So to that end, I think there's something to be said for having, there really should be, everyone here, even the police department would like to see a more diverse police department.
Sure. On both sides.
Yes. I mean,
both white
early,
and both black would like to see more diversity.
Early in my career, I was involved in some efforts to recruit, you know, African-Americans and different, you know, people of different ethnicities. I was sent to various universities. For job fairs, and what we have is the result of that effort. For whatever reason, I think it's difficult to attract people of various ethnicities to this town when they're not from this town.
Okay.
Because, I mean, if you're getting out of college and you have a degree and you feel like you have options, would you rather work in Indianapolis? Or would you rather work in Champaign?
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
There's more culturally going on in Indianapolis,
absolutely.
Chicago, and all these other places.
Absolutely.
So I think there's an inherent difficulty attracting people to this agency.
Okay.
Now, for whatever reason, it doesn't seem like there have been an awful lot of people that have come out of this community that want to work in this agency. I don't know what the reason for that is.
That's interesting. That's something to look forward to in the future. That's really interesting. I want to bring in a soundbite. One of the reporters did a fantastic job. Tiffany Jolly was down on the ground in Ferguson and captured the real essence and emotions of some individuals that kind of ties all of this in together as far as the tone.
Do you know what it's like to get spit upon? Do you know what it's like for a police officer to tell you that I'll take this gun and plant it on you because I don't want you out here because you're a nigger? A nigger is a hate, slave, trade word that we will not use. We will not use. This is a psychological warfare. And until we all wake up and know that psychologically we are mentally messed up, saying that it's okay because he killed him because he stole a box of cigarillos. $5 don't take your life, baby. $5 don't take your life.
And that was a comment right there on the street of Ferguson that just kind of captures that. And it really kind of points to the pain that I hear resonate, the anger that it does not make sense. It's not making sense. And just for a point of record, I wanted to just correct one thing. I said 7 police officers of the Champaign Police Department's 142 member staff, 88% or 125 individuals are white. Of the Urbana Police Department, 70 member staff, 59 individuals, about 84% of its staff are white. And of the 153 member Champaign County Sheriff's Office, 141 individuals, about 92% of the staff are white. And I'm not implying that we've had issues or problems here of a magnitude that rises to other national stories or anything along those lines. I wanted to make clear, though, about the numbers. Because I had mentioned 7 and that was another police department that I was referring to. So I want to make sure that I clarify that. You're listening to Beyond Ferguson You can join us at 1-800-222-9455. I have James on line 4 that I'm going to go to momentarily. But I wanted to talk real briefly about this black rage, about this black anger, and that it actually does come to the point where you don't want to keep excusing yourself and finding reasons why others should not fear you or whatever the case may be. There is that fear. There is this anger about certain aspects. So I think that's real. But I want to get to James on line 4. James, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Janice, and thanks for having the show. I'd like to, you know, return to some of the structural issues that Professor Chajua had raised earlier. And in particular, I think we need to recognize that incidents like the killing of Michael Brown are but a small piece of a much bigger policing problem which relates to mass incarceration. And that is a much more common outcome of unpleasant encounters between police and African-American youth and other youth of color is that they get thrown into the criminal justice system and get disproportionately punished. And we've seen over the course of the last 3 decades the size of the prison and jail system quadruple. And I think it's important, particularly in a state like Illinois, where 58% of the people in the Department of Corrections facilities are African American, while only 15% of the population is African American. I think it's important that we recognize that it's the same kinds of policing that result in the death of young men like Michael Brown also lead to the disproportionate incarceration of African Americans and increasingly Latinos, and that this is a major factor creating what some people seem to be referring to as black rage, and also creating a mistrust of police. And when the police forces are disproportionately white, there's an equation of that white police force with the disproportionate incarceration of African American youth. So I think it's important that we keep this off of, yes, it's bigger than Ferguson, and yes, it's also bigger than the attitudes of individual police, but they're acting within the context of a criminal justice system that has gone dreadfully wrong, that's enforcing what some people refer to as a new Jim Crow. And I don't think we can talk adequately about the Michael Brown case in Ferguson without keeping that in mind.
Okay. Thank you, James. Thank you for calling in. And we have to keep all, we have all that to come in. Donald, do you have a response? And then do Sundiata, please.
Yeah. I'm going to respond to that because I'm a board member of the Illinois Prisoner Review Board. As it relates to the population in the prisons, I see the reports. I see the discipline reports. I'm one of the ones that makes the decisions about whether or not a person is going to remain in prison or whether we're going to give them another chance if they're violating their parole. So I know a little bit more about this than the caller does. And my question, I suppose, is do you disregard the behavior that resulted in incarceration? I keep hearing these conversations wherever I go that seem to imply that the main reason why we have this unbalance in prison and the main reason we have is enforcement. No one will say anything about whatever the behavior was that resulted in there being a police call in the first place. Mm-hmm. Now, I agree. I have no doubt that there are officers out there doing things that they have no business doing. I have no doubt, only because I don't think law enforcement communities are any different than other communities. There are people involved in law enforcement that probably should be washing dishes, and there are people, you know, just there are people in the court system that probably would be better off flipping burgers.
Mm-hmm. You're right, because we're not just talking about police officers. We're talking about school administrators. We're talking about judges. We're talking about officials that do, they have power. But also think about, and something you brought up, and I think what you're alluding to, one of the aspects that we have to extend, and again, in this hour, we can talk about, I mean, it's so many, there's so many elements added to that. But we can also talk about, in these cases, the punishment does not fit the crime. In these cases of the Trayvon Martins, to be judged and to be executed, and I use that in quotes, as far as some would say that Trayvon Martin did not have an opportunity to defend himself. He did not have an opportunity to exercise his masculinity of defending himself. He did not, because he was not committing a crime necessarily. And we look at, when we look at the incarceration and we look at how individuals are judged, people are human beings. And there are some aspects, and we find case after case, where it is not the same. It is not balanced. It is not fair when it comes to the sentencing in certain elements. So we do have more African-Americans in jail than other aggregates who have committed some of the same crimes. Well, and we've seen that even with DUI.
You use the word sentencing, but certainly the Trayvon Martin case.
In jail, too, as well.
The person who exacted a sentence had no right to exact a sentence at all. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's a conversation that's not even on the board for me. That's not a legitimate argument.
Okay.
You're not going to get an argument from me that there's some really disparaging things going on.
Sure, sure. Absolutely. And, you know, and no system's perfect, but we're going to try to get there. Sundiata, a quick comment, and then I'm going to go to the lines. We have two other lines. I have Andrea on line one. Andrea, we'll come to you momentarily. 1-800-222-9455. Sundiata, real quickly, respond to that. I know you want to respond to that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to throw out a scenario to you. Okay. Some of the things that we do know as facts, and I'll use Ferguson because people will have a much greater knowledge of those facts. So one of the things we know, and Chris Hayes talked about this, is that this city of Ferguson and several of the towns in St. Louis County and North St. Louis County derive somewhere between 30% and 40% of their income off of the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. Traffic stops, fines, charges, etc. Mm-hmm. Now, that situation, mm-hmm. they are disproportionately stopping African-American males.
Absolutely.
Right? Even in terms of just jaywalking, because that's why Michael Brown was stopped. Mm-hmm. Okay? So you stop people disproportionately for something like jaywalking, or you give disproportionate traffic stop. That leads to individuals then getting a police record. Then you find a person with one marijuana joint, and they end up in jail. Now, you take this question of drug usage, it's the only statistic in which blacks and whites in this society had the exact percentage of usage, 13%. Mm-hmm. There's nowhere near 13% of whites who are incarcerated for their use of drugs. It's because they target African-American communities and neighborhoods. So when we talk about this policing problem, we have to talk about what areas are flooded with police. Mm-hmm. We have to talk about who is able to afford a lawyer. You know, all of these things are deeply structural.
Absolutely.
And so just to dismiss it on the question of someone's behavior, no. Right. There's a lot of bad behavior going on in America, but people on Wall Street aren't stopped.
Right. And I don't think that, I'm not speaking for you, Don. I don't think Donald was dismissing it. I'm saying that we have to all look at all elements of it as it combines, as it works together. It's almost like the perfect storm sometimes. Not excusing that, and I want to make that clear. But let's
Focus on the individual only. Mm-hmm. That is an excusing the structural and policy elements mm-hmm. of this situation. Mm-hmm. We have to start with the structural and policy, mm-hmm. and then we can talk about
and why were they targeted
behavior.
In the first place? Because if we target and we say that snipers are mostly white male, then should they be pulled over and frisked because they fit the profile? I mean, we have to be fair about it. Let's
murders.
Go to Andrea on line one real quickly. Our last call, Andrea on line one. Andrea, thank you for joining us this morning. Real quickly, your comment or question?
Yes, I just wanted to speak about Black Rage, actually. I think that something that we didn't really get a chance to touch on it, but Black people should be outraged, really. I mean, if they're not, then one, it means that we've become content with what's happening in the society. And two, it simply means that Black lives really don't matter.
Okay.
So I think it's just that the rage is really justified, mm-hmm. especially when you wake up every day wondering if you're going to be next or someone you know is going to be next.
Okay.
So white fear isn't justified, but Black rage and fear, for that matter, should be justified.
Okay. Thank you, Andrea. And I think what we're saying is that it's not justified. It is real. That's my point. White fear is not justified or excused. It's real. But I can also tell you some African-Americans have the same fear and would do some of the same things because based upon an image of a Black male and what has been perpetuated in the society. So I want to thank all the callers for coming in. We are actually, I knew this would go very, very quickly. And I just want to thank everyone for having the courage to call in and actually coming together to get a solution here. I'm going to ask my guests before I thank them to come in real quickly in about 15 seconds, close this up because we're just about out of time. I know. And I'm sorry, but we may have to have a part two. If you want a part two, call in, write in, and maybe we can do that. Aaron,
Well, I'm going to go ahead and advocate for a part two because I feel like I was pretty much closed out of this conversation.
No, I'm sorry.
I will say that I want to make a connection between Champagne and what you said about the numbers and the number of people in the police department
I don't,
and stuff.
Okay, that sounds a little longer than 15 seconds. I'm so sorry you're not close, and I hope.
All right.
I tell you, if we have a part two, you will be back on our show. I promise you that.
I don't know how to close. Thanks for having me. I appreciate being able to be a part of the conversation.
And you know what? And I want to be fair to you. I want to be fair to you. So I'm just going to close right now. I just want to close right now and say thank you to my guests, for Aaron Ammons. I want to thank you, my guest, Sundiata Chachua. I want to thank my guest, Donald Shelton. We have about 1 minute left in the show. And in that 1 minute, I just want to close this by saying thank you also to Jason Croft, the engineer, and Tiffany Jolly for pulling all of this together, and News Director Scott Cameron. Final thoughts. There are great people in this country of all races, ethnicities, religions, genders, sexes, and sexual orientation. And as we have come through many turbulent times, I hope that this is one of them as well. I hope this is a time that we will continue to have the courage to be truthful and honest, and a time to face our own fears so that we can move past them. A time to be bold enough to move past the anger that you feel, to a place of being proactive. For all of us need to take a step in the right direction that leads to peace and a better understanding of each other, as well as respect for each other's similarities, as well as our differences. Until we have our next sip of knowledge together, I'm Janice Marie Collins. I thank you for joining me for the first edition of Theoretical Tea and Company right here, Beyond Ferguson, on WILL AM 580. Have a great day, everybody.